So, do real men cry? Yes, they do. Let's get into it. I am so happy that you are here. And before I get started, let's thank the patrons of the show. Go to patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. And yeah, check out these people. There's 20 of you that support this podcast every single week, month, and year. Justin, Mary, Teresa, Albert, Jeff, Julie, Deborah, Elise, Dominic, John, Jason, Irina, Tony, Michael, Christina, Julie, Brian, Sarah, Arnie, and Barb. Thank you all for continuing to support this podcast every single week, month, and year. I appreciate all of you. Okay. Was gone last week. Wasn't physically gone, but it's just one of those weeks. Tough to navigate all the things, all the storms, all that kind of stuff, but I'm happy that you're here nevertheless. And I was looking through archives of old episodes, and I came across episode 187, which was with Kevin Martillo Viner, and he's written a book. Actually, I don't want to screw this up, so let me make sure I get you the name of the book. Amazon. The Mind-Body Syndrome, A Path to Recovery and Freedom. It's got 4.6 out of 5 stars on Amazon, and I'd recommend that you check it out. But he's been on the podcast a couple of times, but in this particular episode, we got on the topic a little bit of real men crying, which I think is valid. And this was from August 12th, 2021, which I think was just before I did a solo road trip on my motorcycle down the West Coast, and I think that this happened just before I did that. Literally seems like a lifetime ago, because Audrey would have only been 3, Zoe would have barely been 7, and now Audrey is 7, and Zoe is 10, almost 11. So a lot has changed in that amount of time, but I'm still recording the podcast from the same garage that I was before. So maybe not a lot has changed in any event. So wherever you are out there in the world, I hope that you are doing well. I've got a great guest interview that's coming up. She and I are recording, I think it's next Friday, and that'll air the following week. I do plan on doing this episode. I keep alluding to about 2006 and kind of the change of the trajectory of my life and all that stuff. It is important. So, yeah. In any event, love you all. Let's listen to Kevin and I from August the 12th, 2021. Joining me is Kevin Viner. Kevin, can you hear me?
I can, Eddie. Hi.
New York, right? Do I remember that correctly?
Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn, New York. Wow. Where was Biggie from? Was he from the something sty yeah. section of Brooklyn? What was it?
Bed-Stuy.
Bed-Stuy. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. is there a Red Hook section of Brooklyn, New York too?
There is.
Oh, okay. Wow. All right. Well, my Brooklyn knowledge. I went there as a 6-year-old. I have not been back. So, but it's on my, whenever traveling gets normal again, my list is very short of the plate. My wife's always like, let's go somewhere crazy international. And I'm like, you know, I kind of just want to go see New York City and see Boston and see Philadelphia and go to the Smithsonian and do all that stuff. So you're part of the country. It's nice because like just a few hours, you're within a lot of history where it is that you are.
It's true. You know, because if you remember, I'm from the West Coast too. And I grew up on the West Coast. I grew up in Seattle. And for us, it was like anywhere you wanted to go somewhere, you're looking at a really long trip, you know, to even just to get to Portland, Oregon, it's quite far. Yep. If you want to go to California, forget about it. But here on the East Coast, it's like you want to go like to D.C., you're there in a couple hours. Oh, you want to go to Philadelphia? It's right there. You want to go to Jersey, et cetera. Yeah, it's different over here.
It's funny you say that because so I leave on a solo motorcycle trip next a week from today, or sorry, a week from yesterday as we record this next Wednesday. Excellent. And so I live in Seattle, but I'm the furthest south I'm going to go is Daly City. And I kind of want to go to the A's are going to play the Giants at Oakland Stadium, and Oakland is who the Mariners are chasing for the AL West, right, or for the wild card right now. And the Giants are the best team in baseball, and I've never been in that stadium, so that'd be cool to go. But yeah, it's like 15 hours to get there, to get
so
down there.
So far. Yeah.
So yeah, versus if I was in the Northeast or something like that, it certainly would be.
Yeah, I mean, 15 hours, I could be in Miami, Florida, probably.
It reminds me, I went to an event in Dallas several years ago, and I wanted to go. I think the museum I wanted to go to was in Wichita Falls, and I just thought, oh, you know, it's all in the state of Texas. It'll be, you know, an hour drive or whatever. And I popped it in the GPS, and it was like 6 hours each way. And I was, and then when, as I drove it, it's just nothing but flatland and farmland. So the West Coast, even though it's very glamorized because people think of like LA and San Francisco and Hollywood and all that, like a lot of it is just nothing, nothing going on. So
very far away from each other. There's only three states on the, you know, three states on the West Coast. And like, I don't even know how many on the East Coast.
A lot,
like
15 probably. Yeah. Hey, well, thanks for coming back. You know, the last couple of times that we have talked, you'd sent me some points, things that maybe incorporating into our talk. And when we've discussed in the past, some of that discussion has been around the consultation work that you did. But I got this email from you where you had said that you stopped doing consultations. And so I want to just kind of dive right in. You know, what was the change of thought on that? You've written a book that has since come out. And I'm sure that people are reaching out to you because of either reading the book or hearing you on podcasts or whatever the case is, or seeing your name. Why the decision to stop consulting with people?
Yeah. So I don't know that it's permanent. It's, I guess it's more of like a hiatus, and thanks for asking. And, there are really a couple reasons. I would say the first one, the main one, is that it was never meant to be an ongoing thing. I actually started doing some coaching or some consultations sort of to gather some evidence, or not some evidence, but some data for the book, because I really wanted to write a book. I'm an academic, and I like to write about things. And this is a topic that I held very close to my heart. Yeah. Because I got so much help from other people, and I wanted to give it back. And so I thought my best contribution would be a book. So I started initially doing some coaching for free, just to get some, you know, to get some experience, and it went well. And then I started to, after doing some more research, I started to see that actually charging there was a component to it that was actually pretty important. I talk about this a little bit in the book, but it's basically like having skin in the game.
Yep.
Steve Ozanich talks about this. He's kind of mentored me through this entire thing. And he, you know, he, even in through him and in my own experience, for me personally, it really wasn't until I took some steps, a lot of which were financial, towards my TMS recovery, that I actually see some, you know, results. So I started charging, and that it did actually improve. In terms of like people's, I think they just maybe took me a little bit more seriously. And then, so I did that for, maybe a year or so, and it went well, and word was kind of getting out, and I was getting more, and I was seeing more and more people. But then I published my book, and I decided to continue doing the consultations, and I started, charging a little bit more, because then I had a book and everything. But I'll tell you, Eddie, what I found, And I've said this, I think, in our last two talks, you know, I do this stuff strictly because I want to help.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I have a career in a totally field that has nothing to do with this. I actually care about this much more. This is much more special to me, but my point is I'm not doing this for financial gain. And, so I started to see that once my book was published, I made it a requirement that in order to even do a consultation, someone would have had to have read my book and at least started doing some of the work mm-hmm. from it. So I started noticing that I was basically just walking people through my book during a consultation, but I was charging them a lot of money to do it.
Yeah.
But it felt a little like I was scamming people. And not scamming, but it just felt a little unfair. So I started doing, if you remember Dr. Sarno, if you know, in his books and in some of his interviews, you know, he was known for trying to turn people away. Like people would contact him and be like, oh, I really want to see you. And he'd be like, just read my book. It's a lot cheaper. It's $5, you know, versus coming to see me for $300. So I kind of started taking that approach, and people, you know, cause I would be getting contacted, not a ton, but you know, quite a bit. And I would always say, just, you know, I really encourage you to read the book. And, you know, read Sarno's books, you know, take all that information and just integrate it and save yourself, you know, the money basically. And, And that, and I kind of actually started to see that that was working.
Yeah.
You know, because people would check back in and they're like, oh, thank you for your, a lot of people are shocked initially, you know, because they're like, wait, you're turning down money, you know, and a lot of the, and then another big reason was, is the people that I would end up seeing, you know, a lot of them, I mean, because look, I understand the need for connection like that. That actually, there's a huge component of that. Component of that in TMS recovery, I would say, right? So a lot of times that these consultations were really people just wanting to really connect with someone that had gotten through this, you know what I mean? And I get that, but I feel like there are people that are probably better suited for that. People that make this like it is their number one thing they do in life. So specifically for my guy is Steve Ozanich. So I send everyone to him now. So anyone that contacts me, if they need that contact, I say, please contact Steve. He's a professional. He's been doing this for a long time.
Yep.
And he knows, you know, he knows the, what he's doing. And there's other people out there too, that are great, you know? So that's basically that's kind of the main reason is, you know, I was repeating what I was saying in my book and I was getting a lot of people that they want the connection aspect was big, but they actually wanted even a little bit more. I was finding that people were actually kind of almost wanting therapy, and I'm not a therapist, and I'm not, you know, trained in that field. So it kind of started getting a little, some of the boundaries were getting a little weird, you know, because I also had from Steve, I adopted his approach to this is like, basically it's like a one-time thing, you know, like, so my sessions were meant to only be one time.
Yeah.
And maybe there'd be like a tune-up session, but it wasn't this ongoing thing. And a lot of people wanted more than that. You know, they wanted a kind of like a weekly therapy type thing. And I don't know that almost could hinder, there might be some hindrances in recovery there. That's a little out there. We could maybe talk about that another time, but, yeah, so I'm sorry, that was really long winded. I don't want to, I'm sure you have some, comments on that or maybe not.
Well, it's interesting. So I've done, I don't like advertise consultations, but I'll get an email every few weeks that somebody wants to do a consult or coaching or whatever. And I do make it very clear that I'm not a therapist and I'm not looking for anything, ongoing. Let's, you know, a one-time session. And the hope would be at the end of that one-time session that's all that you really need or all that you should have. Because yeah, I agree with you. If we're not trained therapists, it's not our, you know, that's not our thing. It reminds me too of like the requirement of paying, like that element, having skin in the game. It's not exactly the same, but the first thing that came to my mind was when I had reconstructive shoulder surgery about 5 years ago, and I was so diligent about rehab, and my PT would say that often. And I was like, you know, it's nothing special. Doesn't everybody do that? And he told me it's probably 75% of people that have a surgery like I had, like a total joint reconstruction, don't do their rehab. Don't even touch it. And I had just thought, like, why would you go through all of that? And you have the solution, but you won't like do the work to just get to that last 10%, right? So that's one that, you know, it's human nature. Since such a large percentage of people are that way, after talking to Dave and my PT, I guess I'm not surprised at human nature. I don't know. But the other thing that I was thinking of was that Dr. Hanscom, and you can, if you look up his reviews on Vitals or whatever physician review website you want, and you just type up his name, this theme that comes up is that people will say he's got like a 3.5 out of 5 or something. So it's either 5-star reviews where people rave about him saving their life and that they never needed back surgery and all this kind of stuff, or the other people that say he came in and he told me he wouldn't work with me unless I read his book. And that was a requirement. He would say that I won't work with you unless you read my book, and you can't talk. You need to bring family in, and we all need to have an agreement that you will not talk about your pain, and your family will not talk with you about your pain anymore. Mm. And that really turned people off. But again, how vested in this are you? And I think that's kind of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's really based on, this isn't something that I just pulled out of, you know, thin air. I'm very much a, almost, I guess you could say like a, Sarnoian fundamentalists, you know, too. It's like weird terminology, you know, but I could think of a
word. We should get tattoos that say that.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, he took the exact same approach. I mean, Dr. Sarno's approach was that you would be screened. And if you were found that you were, you know, open to these ideas, he would agree to see you, and he would see you one time. And if you didn't improve after, you know, a set number of weeks, I can't remember, it's like 4 or 5 weeks, he would invite you back to one of his talks, you know, a group talk. And it was catered to you. It was like, you know, like these were like, this is TMS. This is what it is. This is how it, this is, you know, the anatomy behind it, or like all the physiological stuff that's going on. And then he would send you on your way. And if you still didn't get better, then you would go to a therapist. And that was it. And that was, those were the steps. He wouldn't see you again, you know, maybe if you had a relapse or something years down. So that, and then Steve adopted that approach in a consultation type, you know, sort of method, very much. I mean, I won't talk for Steve, but I know Steve very well by now. And I think I know him well enough to say that he would agree that that's where he came. That's his approach came from that, you know, this is like, I give you all to you, and you, you know, you have everything you need, because there's nothing more really we can do, because this is all an internal, it's all internal.
Yep.
That's the thing, that if people have a hard time clicking with that, they're not going to get better until they do, because it's, we actually don't do anything. We're merely, you know, we just give information, you know, we share experience. Maybe that's helpful for the connection.
Yep.
And you know, Sarno had the white coat authority, right? So that was kind of what, that was his, that helped his patients really see, because he was a medical doctor. So they were really took that to heart, you know. But this seems to be like, for at least the people that seem to have the best success rates, this seems to be the approach, you know. I mean, you give them, you know, usually one long session. I mean, that's the one of the neat things about TMS world. Doctors, therapists, well, therapists are a little bit different. I think therapists are usually meant to go on for a bit longer, but like specifically medical doctors and coaches and the like, they usually have like a long session, 2-3 hours, you know, something like that. And then you have everything you need, and in theory.
What, so when you had first emailed me about doing this interview, it was about a month ago, and it was, the subject line said sadness and TMS. And you said, I'm beginning to see more and more the role of sadness in TMS. So we touched on it briefly the last time that we had this interview. That's sort of a vague message, but I'm guessing some of this stuff has come up in your in like consulting sessions or people that you've talked to. Let's discuss sadness and TMS.
I'm sorry, say again. I think we got cut off for a second.
Oh, that's okay. I was just saying, let's talk about sadness and TMS. The role of it, and let's kind of shift the remainder of the conversation into that.
Cool. Yes. Excellent. So you know, I hadn't really given it too much thought until our last talk. And that's what's one of the great things about you, Eddie, and your podcast, you know, is, you know, you doing so many of these with so many different people, you're getting so many perspectives, and you yourself have these insights. And I remember in our last talk, you actually mentioned, I don't know if you remember, but you actually mentioned sadness and how you thought, or how you had kind of seen how it could potentially be playing a role in, you know, in TMS. And I hadn't really, for some reason, sadness hadn't really come up too much, you know, in my sort of own experience, or like in my research. And so So just from that little bit that we had in our last talk, I started to look into that, you know, I started to kind of explore that. And I was still seeing, I was still working with people at the time. So I kind of started looking for, you know, how that might be playing a role in their own TMS.
Yeah.
And it was really prevalent. I mean, it was like, you know, like it came in different ways, but like, you know, I was finding that when people were talking about the stuff that they thought was, you know, contributing to their tension and all that stuff, a lot of it was, you know, around loss. You know, you and I had mentioned loss, because I think you had lost like a dear friend. I know I had lost a dear friend. I think you did too, like around the same time or something. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, it depends on the period of time that you're talking about. when I think back to when my stuff got real bad, it wasn't the loss of a person, no.
Oh, okay. Anyway, well, so, but that is a common sort of element in these that I was seeing, you know, loss, and it wasn't always even of a person. It could, you know, be a thing, a job, you know.
Okay, like so that I was going to say that might have been what we were talking about, because for me it was sort of the loss of an identity of a way that I saw myself in the career that I was in.
Oh,
uber
right.
Successful, you know, all this kind of stuff, and I had one pseudo off year, and it really took a toll on me. It really took a toll on me. And when I look back years later, I think sadness was a big part of that. But it was something that, you know, it's not normal to say I'm sad about this. Like if your grandmother dies, yes, it's normal to say that you're sad about that. If you miss a few months of your quota as a salesperson, and you say you're sad, people are going to look at you like you're crazy. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's not, sadness is really frowned on in our, you know, society. I don't know if it's like that around the world, but at least in, you know, US culture, sadness is very much equated with sort of like weakness and that kind of stuff. So it's no wonder that it's one of the more repressed emotions. And it's a core emotion. You know what I mean? It's a core emotion. So I talk a little bit about this in my book. I wish in hindsight, you know, we have all these like stuff that we wish we could go back and elaborate on, but that's why these podcasts are so helpful, actually, right? Because we can talk about this stuff in real time. But, you know, we as humans, we kind of have these, like, we basically have like these primary or core emotions, and they're pretty finite. You know, I mean, we have like, I guess what you say, happiness, sadness, fear,
anger.
And, but a lot of, I mean, anger is also often is like a secondary emotion too.
Sure.
But, you know, but there, I would say there's situational anger, right? Where, you know, if a lion, right, is about to attack you, there's some fear.
Sure.
But then you also need that anger, like to, you know, to fight back or whatever, something like that's not the best example. But yeah, I think most people would agree that those are like, I guess, the four core emotions, right? Happiness, sadness, fear, and anger. So, you know, Sarno and that whole approach was really you know, I really want us to keep this to TMS so we don't get off into some weird psychological stuff that we're not really qualified to talk about.
Sure.
But, you know, Sarno was, as you know, and your listeners, unless they're new to this, mostly know anger was his big one. Anger, rage. He said that's in his view, that was the most commonly repressed core emotion, right? That happens outside of our awareness, and that's what would trigger TMS. And in my book, I tease out the idea, and you and I talked a little bit about this in our one, I can't remember if it was our first or second talks, but you know, where I said, I thought that there was actually a lot of fear that was underneath there, like fear of annihilation, fear of, you know, death, because fear is like, you know, in our core emotions, like in our lizard brain type stuff,
yep.
You know, fear isn't rational, like at all. So like the way that our mind, you know, outside of our awareness might see us losing a job, like you said, or not getting a job, it might be interpreted as, I didn't get the job, I'm going to become homeless, I'm going to starve,
right. Yep.
I'm going to die. So really, it's like, it's about annihilation, right? I mean, that's like the whole, you know, lizard brain is all about just survival, right? So I would, you know, I kind of, in the book, I tease out a little bit that it's like fear of death, fear of annihilation that triggers anger. This is all happening out and our unconscious, and that's what repressed. So it's actually almost more fear than it is anger.
Yeah.
But you know, whether or not, I don't even know how useful that is, to be frank. But I think sadness is right there too. I mean, I think sadness and fear are actually deeply connected. I really do. I'm seeing that just in my own experience and in research. Like, I mean, they're like, there's different external stimuli that will trigger different ones. But if you think about it, just sort of rationally for a moment, if you're really sad, right? If you're really, really sad, you a lot of times, at least, you know, the sadness that you're aware of, you're afraid of allowing it, that it's going to take you over, right?
Yeah.
It's like completely take you over, and you're going to lose complete control, right? So there's a lack of control. And so there's fear around that, right? So
yep.
you're scared to lose complete control. Because why? Because if you lose complete control, what might happen? What's the worst thing that might happen? You might, you might be annihilated. Mm-hmm. You might die. You literally might die. I mean, you know, you won't, but that's what the mind thinks, right? So it makes sense that, like, when we start talking about TMS and we start talking about repressed emotions, that I think sadness needs, I would propose that it needs, that it needs to be discussed more, right? Because it was, I mean, I had researched this stuff pretty thoroughly, and there was very little on sadness, you know? And I don't know, I mean, you do a lot of these podcasts and you talk to a lot of people. And I don't know. Does sadness come up a lot in your talks?
It doesn't. No, I mean, the sadness is cousin grief comes up. But a lot of times when it has been brought up, the if I were to just say grief, like if I didn't know you and I were to just talk about grief, the first thing that may pop in your head, or probably would pop in your head, would probably be grief around a lost loved one, death, like that kind of thing. But a lot of times when grief is brought up in this podcast, it's grief over more of a situation, like what I described about the job, or grief over a here's one. I feel like either a therapist that came on and spoke, or a doctor, something like that. When we were talking about I had gotten to a point where like my body hurt, but I was continuing to like lift and do all the hobbies that I like and things like that. But eventually I've just shut it all down. And I said, until I'm 100% better, I'm going to stop these activities. And then it was like, my body hurt even worse. And I was like, this doesn't even make sense, because I'm stopping my activity, but it's hurting worse. And their response to that was that basically you're going through this grief that you're not even recognizing is there, unconscious, over the fact that you're not doing the things you love anymore. You stopped riding your motorcycle. Absolutely. You stopped weightlifting. You stopped doing this. So like, the grief was more about situations as opposed to loved ones, which I think is what most people would connect to grief.
100%. Yeah. And that's exactly what I wanted to mention. In my view, what I've seen with a lot of people that I talk to, you know, a lot of the clients, there was a lot of sadness or grief. I think I'll use the term sadness, because that's kind of the theme here. There was a lot of sadness around their TMS itself, because the TMS was inhibiting them to do the things like you just said that they wanted to do, right? So when we're working with TMS, right, a lot of it depends. People have different levels of sort of debilitation, right? But some people are like really debilitated. They can't do anything. Of course they get incredible. There's a lot of sadness there, right? But they may not even be aware of it, because the pain is blanketing all of that.
Yeah.
Like you just, actually your example is perfect. I'm basically just, doing a soundboard right back to you, you know, just kind of framing it a different way, in a more like sort of theoretical way. You gave like a real life, and that's great. And yeah, it's that, right? So, you know, I'm finding more and more that in recovery from TMS, for most people, I would say probably nearly all, like there's probably a layer or an element of sadness in there that's going to get, that probably is worth looking at, you know, or considering. I'll just say that, you know, that's kind of new for me too. And I've never been, a lot of people aren't comfortable with feeling sad. I know that for me, it's probably the most uncomfortable feeling, for me, for whatever reason, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, so it's weird, because there's almost like the further you go in your work and this wellness, if we just call it like a wellness practice or a spiritual practice or however you want to say it, you know, to get over your TMS stuff. This has been my experience, and a lot of other people I've talked to and know, you do start to experience more of their emotions, right? Because it's not, they're just by the mere fact of getting and doing this work and getting in touch with yourself a little bit more, and, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, working with your unconscious a little bit more, a lot of those emotions that used to be repressed all the time kind of start to surface, right? So you start to, oh wow, I'm feeling a lot more things, you know? So the good part is, you know, you feel the good feelings and emotions, but you also feel the bad stuff a little bit more. So all this is to say that what I'm seeing and what I've seen to myself is that, like, I noticed that, like, I was becoming more and more acutely aware of being angry. Right. And I, initially, for about a year, I thought that that was just because I was repressing less anger, right? So I was like, okay, so my unconscious, I've tapped in a little bit more. There's a bit more unity between, you know, the conscious and unconscious. So all that repressed anger that Sarno and everyone else talks about so much, I'm feeling it now. Great, right? Great. But with some deeper work and then kind of getting this idea that anger can often be a secondary, right? It's a secondary. It's kind of covering up something.
Yep.
I started realizing there was, you know, recently in the last year or so, that a lot of that was, it's covering up sadness.
Yeah.
It's covering up sadness. You know, some of it's from a long time ago. You know, this is ancient sadness and the stuff we carry in our bodies, you know? So, I have no problem saying to you and to your listeners that, you know, I'm in therapy. You know, I do therapy. It's just something that has really enriched my life. And it's just regular therapy now. I don't see a TMS therapist. But, you know, my therapist and I have been talking, you know, a lot about this. And I don't want to get too personal on your show, but I'll just share a little bit because it might help someone. You know, my therapist suggested that I, you know, to get more in touch with my sadness. And a lot of that means, like, I've always had a real hard time crying. You know, it's just, I don't know. It's just, it's not something that's come natural to me. I wasn't brought up macho or anything like that, but just who knows, you know? And so he started suggesting that I just let my, anytime that I felt like I was going to cry, to completely let it happen.
Yeah.
You know, like even like, and for me, a lot of times it's like, if I'm watching a movie or like a TV show, you know, and it's like, I'm sitting there with my wife or something. I'm just like, you know, I'll feel it coming on. I'm just like, no, I'm not gonna, you know? So I still don't feel real comfortable doing it in front of other people, but my wife and kids were away recently. So I had like about, you know, I had some time alone at home. So I was like, I'm going to really just like, you know, try this out. And I'll tell you, Eddie, man, I watch shows and I kind of pick shows that I thought maybe it would trigger some, you know, emotions. And I just cried by myself and it was amazing. I hope I'm not sounding too like cheesy or, you know, cornball or whatever, but this, you know, just allowing it to happen and there, man, I got to tell you, cause that stuff, it really does. It stores in your body. Yeah. You know, that's what all this TMS is. And I always felt so much lighter. And I used to always think that you had to have a connection between the reason you were crying. Like you had to make like an intellectual connection or else it was like worthless. Basically. I don't even know where I got that idea. I think maybe I think it was something of a psychological idea I got at some point, and I think that there could be some truth to that. Like if you're just like chronically crying and you can't put your finger on it, you know, there could be something there, but for someone who, you know, for someone, if you're like me, whoever's listening and you've had a hard time connecting with sadness, you know, just allowing yourself to cry and letting that stuff out, like you are releasing trapped old, you know, energy, you know, like straight up. So I mean, that was kind of like my own personal experience with the sadness stuff, but it's just crazy how this stuff, you know, the deeper you go, it's like the onion analogy, right? There's just always a different layer, right? You know, different layer you get to. I'm not sure what else to say about that other than, you know, I think it's great that we're getting this out here on your podcast, this idea of sadness and its potential role and TMS specifically, right? Oh, and actually I wanted to mention, this is, so on the other side of sadness is happiness, right? Joy. And I recently had a email exchange with an individual who contacted me. They wanted to do a session and I explained, you know, everything I told you earlier, you know, and I said, this is, I really suggest you try the book first and this and that. And I said, but I'm happy to, you know, do a little, some email exchange with you, help you walk through, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so this person kind of was walking me through their stuff and they confided in me that they were exploring repressed happiness, that they really like joy. I think it was maybe, I don't want to give too, you know, this is like personal stuff, but that there was some joy or happiness, maybe some events, things like that, that they didn't fully, you know, experience, and that was contributing to their sort of, I think, TMS, I guess. So I don't, I thought that was, I think it's interesting to me because I think we always think about this stuff in terms of like negative emotions. And I think it vastly is, but it's interesting that this person had an insight that maybe even like joyous things might trigger some things that are happening outside of awareness. I don't know. I don't know if you've ever.
yeah,
or anything like that.
So the thing that comes to mind when you talk about that, and maybe this is the wavelength that you were on or maybe not, but I think that people that are the TMS Sarno personality type is like people pleaser, perfectionist, all that kind of stuff. And to me, the whole idea of a perfectionist is somebody that never gets too hot, never gets too cold. They're kind of always in the middle. They're basically, if you don't live in Seattle, this might not make a lot of sense, but they're basically like Russell Wilson all the time. Meaning like when he throws a crazy touchdown for 70 yards and it wins the game, he slaps his hands together once and that's it. You would never know. In fact, his reaction to throwing a game losing interception in the Super Bowl against the Patriots was not very different than when he has a game winning touchdown.
Interesting.
And he is a perfectionist. And I think that like, I know for me, in my case, I was talking earlier about like the grief of not doing so hot in my job. Well, the year before when I had at that time, the best year in the history of the company, I didn't celebrate it at all. It was just like I finished the year and then we're just going on to do another year. Even though I had made more money than I had ever made, I had more respect and admiration from my peers than I ever had. I had customers that were super happy with the service. The executive team thought the world of me. And to me, I treated it just like it was any other day or any other year, which sounds great, yeah. Right? If you're talking about somebody, that sounds like, oh, that person's really got it together. But these same type of people, myself included, that have these kind of tendencies, I guarantee they will also beat the shit out of themselves if they have any sort of like a disruption or a disappointment or anything like that. And they won't take that like it's just water off a duck's back, like they do the good stuff. So you're constantly repressing everything. So that makes total sense to me when you're talking about it. The crying thing is interesting. So as you talk about that, I'm the same way. Crying is tough. And I can remember a lot of situations where something was about to make me cry. And it could just be like watching a really great movie that just had a plot that just got me right in the feels. And I'm sitting there with people or even just by myself. And I just won't. I would stop short. Right. Just not let myself go there. My wife wouldn't make fun of me. My daughter wouldn't make fun of me. It's just for whatever reason. I stop before it gets there. I'm a big wrestling nerd, and at WrestleMania this past year, Sasha Banks was going against Bianca Belair for the women's title, and they main evented the show, which was the first time that two black women had main evented any wrestling show, let alone the biggest show of the year. And, you know, they've had this rivalry, it's gone on for a month, and, you know, they've been talking all this trash and these promos and all this kind of stuff for weeks on TV, and then it's the first event that had fans at it since before the pandemic started. And the bell rings, which is when they're supposed to just start going at it. And they, you know, they call it a blood feud, which basically means like, you know, they've been attacking each other the whole leading up to this match. And then the bell rings and the crowd starts going crazy and they both just started crying because of the moment. Right. Like that's a huge moment. You're a female and in a type of entertainment that's predominantly been men forever. But you're also the first black female and actually the first black person, because there's never been two black men that have ever main evented a WrestleMania against each other. So they both stopped and it really caught me in the moment. And I started crying watching this and it wasn't a sad moment. I was so happy for them. And I could feel like, gosh, if I was in their situation, that's got to feel so good. And that's just something that several years ago, there's just no way I would have let myself do that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. You tapped into the compassion there, and that's it's beautiful.
Yeah. And there's a lot of instances that I can think of with that, and I sometimes like with that situation, as the night went on, because the show ended at, you know, 7 o'clock local time or something like that, and I was just thinking to myself like, God, I wonder why I you know, why did it appear like that? And I would try to like kind of in my own head, like justify like, oh, well, I have two daughters and this is two females and they're having this big moment, and so I could see my daughters doing this. And then as the couple of days rolled on and I was thinking about it, and I was rewatching this part and it was still making me feel that exact same way every time, I was just thinking, no, like, it's just a moment. Like, I don't have to have a justification or a reason why that moment occurred. It's just a moment and they're just feelings and that's all they are. So that's the same thing that, you know, judging your negative emotions, thus repressing them. I am a big believer that you can also repress the other side of that, because that's just not what cool guys do. But in reality, like, real men cry, right? That's my opinion anyway, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, we're coming up to the I had said about 40 minutes. I'm curious. I was telling I was saying before the show started that that I had heard a podcast expert talk about recently that kind of the top end of podcast lengths that where the data is coming out is right around 40 minutes is about the ceiling for most people. And we are at 38 minutes. So I'm curious. Excellent. what that listener, anything else that you want to talk about to close? Or you've talked about the book. Where can people find the book if they didn't listen to our last episode?
So I still have my, probably the easiest would just be to go to my website. I still have my coaching website. It's thetmscoach.com. Maybe you could put that in the liner notes too, if you don't mind. And there you can just click on the any image to go to the book. And I do want to say that I just recently, as in yesterday, so whatever, August 9th, 10th, I published the translation of my book in Spanish.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, I wanted to give a special shout out to Miquel Bernado out of Barcelona, who is doing a lot in the Spanish-speaking world for TMS stuff. He's been translating a lot of books. He's helping spread the message. So thank you, Miquel. He helped me tremendously with the translation. And it's available now on Amazon, so you can also get to that if you are a Spanish speaker or if your first language is Spanish and you you know, would feel more comfortable reading in Spanish. The translation is great. And it is also available on Amazon through my website. Just click on the icon. And that is about it from me. Yeah.
Awesome. Hey, well, thanks for coming back. It's always great having you on, especially like a bite-sized episode like this. I feel like we didn't get through a lot, but we kind of did. So thetmscoach.com if you want to learn more. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Eddie.